colorful in illustration and cartoony, and I hated that as a kid. I could appreciate detailed work as a young person. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think sometimes we assume kids only want to have like simple, flat illustrations, but I wanted to create something really like magical.
Bonjour, Anin. Welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lam. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with wonderful guests from a bunch of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, doctors, community leaders, educators, healthcare advocates, you name it. We talk to them. It's just a great mix of passions. We talk to them about their gifts and how they share their gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And it's another week, Cole, another week to amplify Native voices. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm jazzed up, ready to rock. Hope you are too. Hope the listeners are ready for an awesome episode. I know I am.
You're jazzed? Are you yazzed?
I'm yazzed. I need to get my yazz flute out.
I know. I'm waiting for your jazz era.
Oh, that's right. You were saying that.
To go into effect because, you know, I like to do a little jazz vocals here every now and then.
Scat. Just scat. Yeah, maybe. Soon enough.
I think we all go through it. We all go through it.
Soon enough.
Oh, it's nice.
It's incoming. It's incoming. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But let's rock. Let's get going, huh?
All right. Well, Straight to the point.
Yeah. It's one of those types of days, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So today we're very excited to speak with Mary Villiard, a Fond du Lac direct descendant and visual artist based in the Twin Cities. She works in painting, fine art, community engaged public art, graphic design, illustration, and more. She's also a public speaker, community organizer, as well as a grant writer and consultant. Her work has been featured in many shows in Duluth and across the state. More recently, she's been the recipient of the 2023 McKnight Foundation Community Engaged Practice Fellowship and is a 2024-2025 Bush Fellow. And we're going to definitely dive into all that. So, bonjour, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Could you please start out by introducing yourself, letting us know a little bit of your background, where you're joining us from, all that good stuff?
I'm Mary Villiard. I'm a visual artist by profession. Currently based in the Twin Cities, but most of the work I've done has been kind of in northern Minnesota and the Duluth area the last however many years. So, yeah. And I'm currently in school right now, so I'm doing my master's in human rights down here in the Twin Cities at the U of M.
How are you doing? How's the family doing?
Pretty good. I'm in like my finals week, so I'm just writing lots of papers and excited to have a winter break. It's weird to have a winter break because my break is just going to be work. So.
What are some of the papers?
I just did one on the rights of nature movement. And then I'm in a class on like children of incarcerated parents. So my interests are kind of all over the place right now this first semester. And it's an interesting time to be a human rights major, I think, because I guess like any point in American history, we don't have a lot of philosophies that support human rights legally. So,
well, how do you define human rights from your point of view?
See, that's where I'm struggling right now. I personally maybe take a little issue even with like the framework of human rights because it kind of came about theoretically after World War II, after the Holocaust and after like all of these atrocities took place internationally, people started to come together and make these international bodies to support human rights. There's obviously like the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which is just a bunch of articles that explain, you know, what they specifically are. But yeah, it's interesting from the standpoint of, like I said, I was writing a paper on the rights of nature, and I feel like it's really difficult to enforce a lot of our human rights policies when we see humans separate as nature, or at least like the legal systems do. I don't think I'm a great person to ask like what human rights are because I feel like the framework I'm coming at it from is different than everybody else in my class. Like everyone is looking to get jobs at like the UN and like all these different places. And I'm like, I just want to make art and know about these social issues and the conditions that lead to some of our social injustices and create better artwork around it. Because it is a very academic topic, and I feel like that information just doesn't get disseminated very well.
Well, before we jump in too far, is there anything, Miri, that you're really thinking about?
I've been thinking a lot about how our society in America as a whole functions on pretending problems either don't exist or like people with different opinions don't exist. And so we just don't talk to them, especially after the last election with people being surprised by the results. I've just been thinking a lot about like our disconnects between each other. And I feel like my purpose as an artist is to sort of find and elicit those disconnects, but also get people to a space where they can see where each other is coming from in some capacity. On my mind right now is just all of our disconnects. And how do we fix those? Because we're just going to keep spiraling out of control and repeating really bad histories if we don't address them.
Gotcha. Well, let's get into your work a little bit. Like, what are you working on right now as far as your art projects and all that?
My current baby right now is called Waiting for Beds, and it's a traveling art exhibit that looks at what happens to people when they're in a crisis, whether it's mental health or homelessness or domestic violence, things like that. What happens when people are in those crises? They call a hotline for help, and then they're told they have to wait. And so looking at that window of time of, you know, what is the experience of waiting in America specifically, that project has been heavy. It's got a component of my work. I'm collaborating with Carla Hamilton, who's another artist, and she comes at it kind of from the perspective of someone who's been institutionalized in different degrees. And then we have a community component where I've just been gathering data from people and collecting objects and artwork people want to submit, talking about their experience waiting for a bed. I feel like as an artist, my role is to really like take things that you can't see and kind of like, I always imagine just like pulling them kind of out of the sky and then bringing them into like this visual field where you can experience it or understand it or know it exists because you're seeing something connected to it artistically. That's my baby.
Is it showing someplace right now?
It'll be at the 210 Gallery in Sandstone, I believe, in March. And then I have a kid's book that I illustrated with the authors Evan Larson and Melanie Montano. And that'll be coming out hopefully in the next year. It's about the Ojibwe practice of prescribed fires and just like that history. Evan Larson's been doing research on that, and it's kind of fascinating. So I've taken like 6 years to finish those illustrations. So I'm very excited to see them actually culminate into a book that'll be available soon.
And that's a children's book, you said?
Yep.
Oh, lovely.
No spoilers, but like, could you talk a little bit more about the book and like what it presents?
Yeah. Evan is based out of the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. He's not Native, but he's been working with a lot of Native researchers to kind of look into this history of prescribed fires, which, long story short, the U.S. banned a lot of traditional fire practices that a lot of Indigenous communities had across the United States. And that kind of has been part of the reason we see such crazy wildfires now today, is because people were stewards of the land and they were managing the land with fire. And when you ban that, it allows for like this buildup of debris and underbrush. The story is about a grandmother and her granddaughter picking blueberries and talking about the history of Ojibwe agriculture connected to prescriptive fires, allowing for blueberry harvest every year. It kind of ends in the present tense with the fires coming back. The renewed interest in bringing back those agricultural practices.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Miri Villiard, a visual artist, public speaker, and community organizer based in the Twin Cities. She's a direct descendant of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And what's the collaboration process like, bringing that story to life?
For me, it's been fun because I feel like a lot of the work I've been doing recently has been connected to almost like creating work for my inner child. And so to be working on like a children's book, it's kind of been fun to put my mind back in that very like childlike mode and to think of what would little Miri like to pick off a shell and be absorbed in. When I was a kid, I was a little bit odd because I feel like a lot of kids' stuff is simple in illustration and cartoony, and I hated that as a kid. I could appreciate detailed work as a young person, I don't think I'm alone in that. I think sometimes we assume kids only want to have like simple, flat illustrations, but I wanted to create something really like magical. So I've been playing a lot with color and how do I make something that if a kid is looking at this, they can kind of get absorbed in these little details and find hidden things in there. And it's my first time doing something where there's cohesion amongst characters. So it's been a huge learning process. Like I said, it's taken 6 years to do these illustrations, and most of it has been over the summers because I procrastinate a little bit, but we got there. We're getting somewhere. So,
yeah, I really like the details because it's not often just a child looking at a book too. It's their adult or whoever. And I always found it to be really lovely when you could experience the book almost like new every time you went in, just because there's so much added detail that you might have missed in the first time through.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice to have a complex universe for our young ones to explore.
You just unlocked a memory with the Where's Waldo books. You could see like little actions, little characters doing something. You always found something new.
There's all these memories I have forever until they go away, I guess. But one of those memories is we had like a show and tell day in second grade. And we were supposed to pick a book and read it to the class. And I picked something about these Mandarin ducks. Everybody else was picking the cartoony, flat, ugly books. And then here I am with this really like elaborate illustrated book that didn't really have a cover that was alluding to how much art was actually in the book. And I remember opening it for the class and somebody was like, oh my gosh, that's so pretty. And they just weren't expecting to appreciate, I guess, what was in the book. And that is like a core memory that's been playing in my head every time I work on an illustration for this book is, you know, you just open it up and have that reaction. I did a lot of thinking about the beginning part of the book is probably taking place sometime in the 1800s. And so thinking about the historical context. A conversation we had with the book was trying not to reinforce this narrative that Indigenous people didn't exist. If we're focusing on these two characters in the beginning, is there ways to show that there's like life happening around them? So it's things as simple as like a fire smoke in the background or the shadows of people on the water. And they're not the focus of the story, but there's like human interaction with the land happening that they're sort of moving through. And I think the research is really trying to pinpoint the fact that the United States isn't land untouched. This idea that like we need to leave the land alone and completely cut off people from interacting with it gets back to that point where modern society or Western society just looks at humans as separate from nature, that any interaction with nature is going to be harmful when the reality is maybe the Western conception of how we interact with nature is harmful, but there's ways to be part of it and to be a steward. And so that's the final message, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Or perhaps we are nature.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No matter how hard we try.
Right.
To deny it. So, Miri, I think I've experienced your work now for 9 years, 8 years, maybe? Gorgeous colors, and often on a larger scale. The like portrait pieces that you do. Of course, the murals, the famous Miri murals. Can you talk about scale? What draws you to a larger scale?
Part of it was a little bit accidental, getting into larger scale work, just from the standpoint of when I was doing the smaller work, I ended up getting some sort of problem with chronic pain. At the peak of like when I first started out and was doing the portraiture work, I was doing so much painting and I was like getting ready to be the artist like full time. And then I overdid it, wrecked my arm and needed arm surgery. And then like went through years of physical therapy to still not have a diagnosis formally of what the problem is. When I got into more public art stuff, the broader motions of like being able to move my arm further and not focus so much on the fine motor stuff served to alleviate some of the problems that were causing issues in my wrists and my elbow in particular. And then when I started doing community collaborative art where like people are helping me, they kind of became my paintbrushes in a sense. If I need a break and like my body's not cooperating with me on a certain day, I can ask somebody like, oh, can you put the color here or make a decision here at this point? You know, I need a break, which has really served to kind of make the process a little bit less ego-filled, I guess. I don't know how you describe it, where I kind of have gotten really used to kind of handing my stuff off to people to either add to or finish or be engaged in some way in. And another unintentional aspect of that has just been being able to be an audience to my own artwork in a sense, because if I don't control every aspect of it, then there's these unexpected things that happen. When I step back and I see them, I get to enjoy them almost like I'm not the person in charge of making the art. It was unintentional, and now it's very intentional because I discovered the joys of all the things that working bigger alleviates. I think all at once, the largest piece I've worked on was 60 feet wide by needing scaffolding high. I don't remember how high specifically it was. And then I'll actually be working on a mural with Thomasina Topbear sometime in the next year or two here in the Twin Cities. And that piece will be, I think, around like 200 or 300 feet wide. It's huge. We've never had a collaboration with each other before. So it's going to be just like a learning process of collaborating with someone new and then also working huge. So that'll be, I think, I don't know my neighborhoods in the Twin Cities very well yet, but like St. Anthony, Maine is a phrase that I've heard. So.
How do you outline something like that before you start putting something on a wall or whatever?
There's a couple different ways to do it, but I usually do something called a doodle grid, which is like where you doodle all over the wall, you take a picture of it, and then you kind of do a transparent overlay on technology, and it kind of shows you where to map things out so the scale isn't destroyed. Because, yeah, working at a scale that big. So.
I feel like I can always kind of tell when something's a Miri Villiard painting. And I know Cole has a turtle. Last year, you were selling turtle paintings. I got a bunch for my family, so they all have one. And my husband has his bison head. See, I don't have the correct vocabulary to describe somebody's artwork in particular. So if you could do me the honor and help maybe describe how you hope your visuals come across.
Color is really important to me, so I feel like I'm constantly trying to take like really vibrant colors and pair them next to really neutral, almost like ugly colors, because I like how they complement each other and make for something that's different. As far as like the turtles and the fish series that I've been working on, those kind of came about because people were asking like if they could buy artwork from me, and I always felt bad because I don't really have anything that I like sell. The paintings that I do have, they take years sometimes to do because I just don't get to do that smaller scale painting as much. And so with the turtles, it was kind of like, I don't know, this epiphany I had where I could make affordable art for people to enjoy. And they also feel kind of like you're taking a piece of some of my designs that have been murals. So like the Chief Buffalo Memorial in Duluth. We did lots of like community painting sessions in that project. And a lot of the walls are just these fish and turtles and aquatic creatures that people designed. They were just so fun and so simple and so joyful. And so like when I get to create those, it's kind of like almost like a mindless art that I get to do where I don't have to think about social issues or some of the heavier stuff that my paintings usually explore. And so they're just like these little joyful things that I enjoy painting. They don't destroy my body, and they're like a little piece of a greater puzzle of murals. And then describing my broader stuff, surrealism is kind of the category a lot of my paintings fall into, and the design I work with falls into. I like to kind of balance a hyper realistic subject in a very dreamlike world that or environment that's kind of around it, and play around with patterns and just the vibes, I guess, when I'm painting.
Let's take a step back. Like, what set you on your artistic path? Do you remember a moment where you decided that this is what you wanted to do, or did it happen over time?
But there was a point, I think multiple points when I was really young, where I just wanted to be a famous artist someday. You know, and I think I never lost sight of like, you know, when you're asked when you're in kindergarten, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I stuck with artist or like creative. I think also in my family, even though I don't have a great relationship with, you know, my immediate family, but I will say like it was encouraged for me to be an artist. My grandma was a muralist. I didn't know her super well, but a lot of people in the family have compared me to her, so that's kind of cool. And then on my dad's side, there was a great-grandfather who was also a muralist, and so there's like this weird kind of lineage of painters. And I think a lot of them didn't necessarily make it to the level that they wanted to. When they had kids, their kids were like really encouraging their offspring, I guess, to like become artists in some capacity. It was something that I think growing up, it was encouraged. I guess a formative memory for me was my dad had bipolar schizophrenia, and when he was off his medication, he would draw on the walls a lot. Growing up, the freedom to like illustrate the walls was a big part of my childhood, and I think maybe served to help me not have like that fear of engaging in different surfaces with pencil or paint or things like that. Because I've noticed a lot of people, especially when I do community painting sessions, there's a fear of what if I mess this surface up, and so they don't want to. I don't think I was ever allowed to have that feeling because we were messing up the walls all the time. I have one memory where my dad, he'd like traced some of the Ojibwe florals that were at the tribal clinic. I think Wendy Savage designed them, and he had traced them with paper and then brought them home and then traced them onto the wall. And then I remember using paint markers with my dad and like coloring in the florals that he took from the tribal clinic and put on our wall. That's definitely one of my earliest art making memories that always sort of sticks with me. And even when we did the Chief Buffalo Memorial and Michelle Defoe created florals throughout there, that was something that I pictured of like, oh, there might be a parent who comes here and traces this floral and then puts it on their wall or beads it into their own design, and how like those florals are kind of like a gift to the community where they can repurpose them and feel a sense of connection in that way.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Miri Villiard, visual artist, public speaker, community organizer, and direct descendant of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
Could you speak on any mentors that you had?
It's funny, I feel like there weren't a ton of art teachers that I felt connected to growing up, so I never went to school for art because of that. I feel like they were always trying to push me in a direction, and sometimes like I just wanted to play with the materials. Like, I didn't care so much what the end result was, and so when I was younger, I didn't really stand out for my art necessarily in art class because they were just annoyed that I would make muddy colors and just be a kid. But I did have an art teacher in high school who, yeah, maybe this is it. People who allow me to draw on their walls. My art teacher, Kemptar, in high school basically like gave me free rein and allowed me to like paint all over the art room walls, whatever I wanted, no questions asked. And so that was kind of another experience where I just got to play around. They weren't great murals, but I learned a lot about like working on scale, and ended up doing like our high school senior mural, which was my first community engaged project, because in the past, senior year, ESCO High School, every year people would get to come up with a senior mural, and usually it went to like the artsiest kid to kind of design that mural. And I remember looking at the previous murals and just being like, this feels like one person's vision. It didn't seem like it represented the class as a whole. And so I kind of wanted to try and do something where I got every single person to engage in the mural one way or another. And so I put out a survey my senior year, and I was like, what do you want to see? And then in order to get people's graduation like diploma, I made it a requirement that people put their fingerprint on the mural. So it made it that everybody touched the wall at least once, and that it wasn't just me painting. It's weird that they allowed me to do that, but it was kind of a cool branching out into that idea of, I thoroughly believe that you can incorporate everyone in some way into the process.
You talked about, you know, colors and some themes behind your work, but are there certain animals or things that come up again and again in your work that you just like to incorporate?
I'm really big on hands right now. I always have been really interested in like drawing and painting hands. I think of how much hands are, I guess, a part of our interaction with everything around us. And it's a way of incorporating humans without being specific about who, I guess, is in the piece. You'll see a lot of hands in my work. And then usually if there's like an animal, it's connected to the context of whatever I'm creating. So specifically in public art, like if you see an animal, it's usually something that I saw nearby that I want to honor in some way, I guess. I kind of look at them as like a spirit helper where they're kind of there and I just want to recognize that they've showed up and are engaged in that space in some way. So like as an example, when I did the animated projection Madhway Ashka over the St. Anthony Falls lock, when I did the site visit, I remember going down there to the falls with the park ranger and he saw a loon in the lock area. And the park ranger was like, we've never, ever seen a loon downtown Twin Cities in this water. So a big part of the visuals for that piece was, you know, the image of the loon swimming, which I then created like a little small animation. This little kid ran up to the wall where the loon was swimming and started kind of like chasing it with his hands. And I just was like, again, thinking about that inner child, thinking about like, what would the experience be to walk up to this wall and to see this glowing loon, and to them, maybe it's real, right? And how those images get instilled into your brain, and then how maybe that image could inspire, you know, artwork or dreams or something for that kid in the future. So
we like to ask, you know, final thoughts, anything, you know, you'd like to mention that we haven't talked about. If you have any advice to somebody who might follow a similar path.
Ooh, as far as like getting into the art realm, to be successful at it and for it to be your career, you have to be good at other things besides art, unfortunately, which is something I think a lot of artists learn once they decide on it as a career path. Sometimes you're hiring people, which means dealing with taxes and budgets, and you have to be good at writing if you're going to get grant funding and PR for your exhibits and stuff like that to make sure people actually show up for things, which I've been pretty bad at actually, but being an artist is multiple jobs in one. Just don't lose touch with kind of like the inner child.
Mary Villiard, there you have it.
That's so great. When I think of artists, just in my own stereotypical mind, I think of like the grueling, alone, in I don't know where, in some room with good light though, toiling away.
Yeah, a lone wolf.
But this sounds so fun, this inclusive, collaborative art.
Mm-hmm. So miigwech to our guest, Mary Villiard, visual artist, public speaker, community organizer, all that great stuff. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
KFAI is proud to sponsor Trans Day of Revenge, presented by the Twin Cities Trans Mutual Aid at the Cedar Cultural Center on Saturday, January 18th. Celebrating resistance in the forms of solidarity, love, and trans joy, the Cedar is honored to host the Trans Day of Revenge, benefiting the Twin Cities Trans Mutual Aid. Featuring performances by SLOG, Horse Divorce, and more. Visit thecedar.org for more details.
From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. We'll be bringing you the current updates that matter to us all, from the Shakers and the Makers in Indian Country. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. On today's show, we're honored to bring you one of the last interviews recorded with the late Tom B. this past summer. It was a privilege to have him on the show and learn all about his remarkable journey, from founding the Native band Exit to initially managing the band before stepping into the role of lead singer. Exit made history as the first Native American band to sign with a major record label. and Tom's extraordinary career later earned him 2 Grammy Awards. All this and more, but first, the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.